Talk about the Greens, that bunch of idiots.
Hey there, Climactic Collective listeners.
I'm Emerald Moon.
And I'm Tom Bella.
And together we host Serious Danger,
a podcast about Australia's broken political system and its greatest threat,
the Australian Greens.
It's a show about green politics in Australia.
The kind of politics that puts people and the planet before profit.
We talk to cool and interesting people about fighting for good shit, like taxing billionaires,
housing for all,
workers' rights,
First Nations justice,
and drugs. Sweet, sweet, sweet drugs.
Join us on Serious Danger every Sunday. You can subscribe to us anywhere you get podcasts.
You can find us on Patreon. We're at Serious Danger AU on the socials, or just head to seriousdangerpod.com.
That's Serious Danger with me, Emerald Moon.
And me, Tom Ballard. Do you think we need something at the end there? Go Greens.
Welcome to the Good You Can Do podcast, where we share tips and strategies to help you reduce waste, live a healthier life, and protect the planet for future generations. My name is Andrew Duncan, and you can find out more about this project at our website, goodyoucando.com.
Couple of very quick announcements before we jump in. I think you're really going to love this episode. Mike's journey is so inspiring. If you have ever thought about leaving your current role behind to do something fun or work with plants or just do something that's in line with your passions, then I think you'll really enjoy listening to Mike's story. And our discussion, we talk about a thing called the Earthworkers Program, which is a real life-changing educational program that I went on last year. It's run by the For the Love of Bees Charitable Trust. It's a real deep dive into the whole way that plants work and all about the modern way of kind of urban farming. And if you're interested in that space, even if you're just interested in growing food at home or just to hearing about how plants can save the world, then I'd really encourage you to check it out. Their next course is on the 16th to the 20th of May in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. You can find out more just by Googling Earthworkers Program or Googling For the Love of Bees, and I'll also put a link to it in the show notes as well. Quick shout out to Climactic, the Climactic Collective, which is the podcast network that Good You Can Do is part of. If you're interested in more amazing climate-focused podcasts from the Australasian podcasting community, go and check out climactic.fm, and you can check out the Climactic podcast itself as well. And one last comment, this episode was recorded while we were holidaying in Auckland, and the mic quality is pretty average. I didn't have my usual mic with me, I was just recording it on the Bluetooth headphones, so apologize that it's not really top-notch, but I think you can still get the message, and most of the time it's Mike talking anyway, so you'll be able to hear his wonderful story. And without further ado, let me introduce you to Mike King.
Mike, thank you so much for taking a bit of time to jump on the podcast. Mike is a professional arborist by background, but has recently been on a bit of a transition. He's transformed a previously, can I say, kind of abandoned space at Otaki College into a thriving urban farm and garden, which we'll talk a bit more about. And Mike's also runs foraging tours around the Wellington Botanical Gardens and also in on the Kapiti Coast, where Mike lives, where you can go on a tour with him and learn all about native plants and edible plants that you might have just previously walked past and not really thought much about, which is a super cool way to engage with nature. And I'm super excited to hear more about that today. But Mike, we originally met at the Earthworkers course, or through the Earthworkers program, last year in 2021, which is a regenerative horticulture learning experience put on by For the Love of Bees, where I guess to describe it in a small way, they teach you how to grow a whole lot of plants and vegetables in a really small space, like super hyper intensive farming, in a completely regenerative, biology first, organic way. And it was quite an experience going through that. And maybe that's a good place to start. I was going to say, what attracted you to doing that Earthworkers program in the first place, coming from that arborist background?
Mm. Morning, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mike.
Good question. I was very nervous about starting this project at Otaki College, and I was looking at the weedy fields that lay before me and had really no clue about growing veggies and those sorts of things. So I thought, yeah, this could be something that would help. And it really did. I was really glad I went on the course. It gave me a lot of answers for a lot of questions. I was surprised, though, because I have previously done quite a lot of training. I'm a German qualified arborist and a German qualified landscape gardener because I have a German wife and I spent 10 years in Germany. But I thought I had knowledge on soil science and soil health, but not really. I did learn a lot about bacteria and biology, and it was really useful.
What led you to finding that space at Otaki College? You know, like it, coming into that situation, even though you didn't, maybe didn't feel like you had all the tools or knowledge to make it work, but you I guess you saw the space and thought, man, that could be better utilized. Or how did that opportunity come about for you?
Can I back it up a bit more?
And please.
I'll just start from the beginning. When we came back from Germany, it's going on 8 years now, I suppose. I thought to myself, I can't keep doing tree work 5 days a week. It's great fun. Days go by really quickly, but it's wearing my body out. And 2-3 days would be fine, but 5 is just too much. So I started growing oyster mushrooms in a shipping container out in front of my house. It was great fun. Learned it all on YouTube. Fascinating stuff. Learned pretty quickly, though, that the daily grind of growing mushrooms is not really where it's at for me. Yeah, they go off quite quickly and you've got to sell that product. And it was interesting, though, and I started selling them at markets and I started selling them to restaurants. And so I got to know one restaurant in particular called 5050 down Paraparaumu Beach. The chef there, Helen Turnbull, she's a very passionate chef. She does a lot of degustation menus, small portion, experimental cuisine sort of thing. And one day she asked me if I could find her green walnuts to pickle them. And I said, yeah, no worries. But how about trying black walnuts or Japanese walnuts? You want to have a go with those? And she said, oh, anything that's edible, bring it in and we'll have a play with it. So I did that. Basically, I dedicated every Wednesday to foraging for her. And that was a lot of fun. I was really amazed, actually, by how many plant products I could bring in. I like to talk about plant products because each plant has more than one product. If you think about a pine tree, it has the pine needles, the pine cones, the pine pollen sacs, the pollen itself, or the resin. So, a pine tree has 5 or 6 products already. And I was really surprised by how many plant products I could bring in. For at least the first year, every week, I would bring in at least 3 new plant products. It worked really well with my tree work. I would get out to a lot of lifestyle blocks and really nice properties, go down all those long gravel driveways that no one ever goes down. And there's some beautiful lifestyle blocks here on the coast. And the people were really interested in what I was doing, and they were always willing to let me pick a few berries. And it was great. So I did this for 2 years working for her. A lot of fun, learned a lot. And then I started posting things on Instagram. Got some interest from gin distilleries. Gin's popular at the moment. They're all looking for new native botanicals to, give their gin the edge in the market. And they want everything dehydrated. So I started dehydrating things, realizing that I started getting fascinated by the fact that some things intensify their magic and some things lose it completely. And somewhere along the lines, I realized that we can expand on our native spice range. If you think about New Zealand native spices, it's horopito leaf, kawakawa leaf, and that's about it. But we can, I realized we can actually do more than that. It was a couple of interesting discoveries, but we can talk about that later. But so I started working for gin distilleries, trying to find them large quantity. I spent like a year running around finding them botanicals, just running around trying to find them samples. And that was really interesting too. I was fascinated by all of this. Somewhere along the lines, I realized that I don't really like gin as a way to showcase a flavor. Gin is what it is. And, it's like blending and complementing flavors and all that sort of thing. But as a way to showcase an individual flavor or an individual spice, I didn't really think like it was doing them justice. So I got a bit frustrated with that. And somewhere along the lines, I realized that ice cream is a great way to showcase flavors. Cream and sugar just carry a lot. It doesn't work for every flavor, but it did work for a lot of the native flavors that I was trying to showcase. And so I started adding that to my foraging tours. I didn't really feel, for a long time, I never really felt comfortable doing foraging tours because I didn't really feel like I had enough to offer to make it a good tour. And then once I started adding ice cream to the tours, people walked away with a smile on their face. Like maybe it was just the sugar and cream, but it worked every time. So I'd add ice cream to my tours, and that was great. And then at some stage, I stumbled into being on a Country Calendar episode, which was bizarre, but also a lot of fun.
It's brilliant too. I'll link to that in the show notes for everyone. It was the 2021 season episode 13. If anyone wants to Google it, you can just look up Mike King Country Calendar, but I'll link to it in the show notes as well, and I definitely recommend it. Just watching you climb up the trees was crazy cool. Reminded me of this book I read called The Wild Trees, all about people climbing redwoods.
I remember that one. Yep.
It was always really cool to see someone actually doing what they talked about in their book and practice. So, sorry, that's a bit of a segue, but I was...
I actually wrote that guy a letter when I was living in Germany. I read that book, The Red Giants or something like that from Stevens. Yeah. Something like that. And I was so inspired by it at the time that I wrote him a letter asking if we can come over and give him a hand or something. And he actually replied. I didn't expect that either.
Steve Sillett,
wrote us an email back saying just recommending a few German scientists who were doing interesting work on Douglas fir trees if we would prefer to work with him, because he's not taking on volunteers. He just works with his students because he works at the university. But where was I? Started working for gin distilleries, started making do these foraging tours, went on Country Calendar, blah, 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 that's right. And then, I've started noticing over the years that it would be good to get out of tree work in the long run. I only really enjoyed the climbing. Tree work is awesome. Climbing is a lot of fun. There's been a lot of development over the last 15 years with techniques and tools that you can use too. So just it's always been a developing industry, and it's been a lot of fun to be a part of that and to watch it grow and see the tools and constantly learning new things. And that was always great. But New Zealand's not that nice for tree climbing, to be honest. I mean, Germany was a lot of big old oak trees in the middle of cities, nice big trees, and it felt more like extreme sport rather than a job. Whereas when you come back to NZ, it's just smashing out pines, macs and gums and poplars and shoving them through the chipper. Right. And you're never really pruning a big old tree. And it just kind of the grind of New Zealand tree work has been getting to me over the years. And I have been looking for a way to get out of tree work, and never really saw a way to fully get out of it. And I was happy doing a couple of days. That's fine. But one day I was, here we go. So the mayor follows me on Instagram, the mayor of the Kapiti Coast. And he's been a fan of mine for a while. And he asked me if I wanted to come along to a food hui organized by the council after COVID regarding food sovereignty and food security on the Kapiti Coast. The Kapiti Coast used to be a real hub for growing. It's great weather up here and the soils are really nice. If you head a little bit further than Waikanae, that Otaki and Levin, the soils get really nice and the weather's a bit better. It used to be considered, before my time, I don't really know it like this, but it used to be considered the fruit bowl of Wellington. And you can still see scattered greenhouses all around, old broken down greenhouses all around the place if you get out a bit. So I tagged along. I didn't really know what I was doing at this food hui, but I tagged along anyway. And everyone was introducing themselves, there was one lady there, Kate Lindsay. She's works at Otaki College. She's a newly employed learning support coordinator, so a social worker at the college. And she mentioned that she came along really because she had discovered this rundown derelict horticultural facility at Otaki College, and she was really keen on getting it back up and running. And when I heard that, I had heard rumours of the place, but I had never seen it before. I jumped on the opportunity and mentioned that I'd be really keen to be a part of it. And so we worked together to acquire funding, and the council organised a few speed dating events for funders and fundees, which I was really fascinated that that's how it works. So you just have 10 minutes at each table and everyone sort of, you both do your spiel and then figure out if you fit in with each other and then move on to the next table. It was just a great way to figure out how we can get funding. And it really worked. We realised while we were there, we both realised that there is a lot of opportunity for funding at the moment in this area. And we acquired funding a little bit from the Kapiti Coast Council and then from the New Zealand Community Trust, so Pokies money.
Did you remember what your kind of pitch was like? In
quite early on, we went to the remakery in I guess Lower Hutt or Upper Hutt,
which is like the common unity, which is in kind of like the Randwick Lower Hutt area. I can put a link to that in the show notes as well. It's an incredible setup.
We went there, and I was really inspired by them. I thought this what a great facility. And but when I was chatting to the lady who first started it, I asked her, it was quite an important question to me. I asked her, did you have a plan when you first started, or has it grown into the plan, or how did, because I really don't have a plan. I'm just sort of like stumbling along here and taking the opportunities as they come to me. And she said, no, the plan is growing. You know, the vision is growing, and it has to do with the people that come along as well, and the direction that they want to take it. It's not all just, you're not going to have the vision that's going to, what it's going to end up being from the beginning. So that was comforting to me. And so I've been working with that sort of philosophy. I don't really, haven't really had an end vision with the project, but it's, but I'm actually really happy with the direction that it's going and the ideas that I've been having. So I went along, we started going to these funding things. We found funding. We've been working with that for about the last 8 months. Funding seems like it will always be an issue, future funding, which is frustrating, because it's not just the security for me, but also you don't know how much you should throw yourself at something, and if you don't know, if you don't have security. So that's been a bit of a frustrating side of things. But but I think we will get future funding, and we will proceed.
Especially that you can show what you've done so far, right? And I'd love to dig in more, and we definitely will dig in more to that project. I was going to ask you about it sort of towards the end, but since you've been speaking into this space about kind of that transition, I'm really keen to dig into that a little bit in terms of, I've done a few episodes with people who have talked about transitioning from one type of kind of career into another. And I'm really interested in the space of, finding what good looks like for you and having the courage to explore that. And I guess the confidence to feel that you deserve to be looking for something that works for you, like a daily setup that you enjoy. The kind of journey that I went on personally a couple of years ago of leaving property world kind of life to wanting to work more in a climate space. And I guess from other people I've interviewed and my own experience, it can be a really challenging process, right? You can go through moments of doubting yourself and being unsure of what you're doing and not having a plan and not knowing what that future is going to look like. And so I was going to ask you, what did your sort of first steps look like? And kind of, I know you mentioned the oyster mushrooms, but what was that process like of kind of understanding that it definitely was time for a change? Because a lot of people will be doing a job, feel like it's not right for them, tough on their body, but still just keep doing it and not take steps to actually make a change. Was there anything that worked for you to kind of help you make that transition, or things that you'd suggest to other people to think about if they're in a space where they're kind of maybe where you were with the arborist, work 5 days a week and thinking, gosh, this doesn't feel like a long-term sustainable future?
I was feeling with tree work, I was really feeling the pressure to get out of it for a few reasons. And it wasn't just because it was really tiring my body out. It was also super dangerous. I mean, I started having, maybe it was through the fatigue of being tired, but started to have regular accidents, pretty crazy accidents. And some of the trees that I get sent up to do are pretty crazy. And I don't know, maybe it's just getting older, having more accidents. And I mean, now I have a daughter too. So there's just this thoughts of the craziness of what you're doing just sort of slowly eat away at you. And I would start to dread the jobs, thinking about lying in bed, thinking about tomorrow's crazy trees. Those sorts of things were definitely pushing me to find a way out or a new direction. And and as I was getting older, the physical side of things I found quite fascinating, just the recovery time. So in the past I could do 5 days a week and then just need Saturday, Sunday, do something quiet and I'll be sweet again on Monday. But after a while, a really, really hard day in the trees, geez, you'd need 2 days to feel normal afterwards, and that's not really sustainable. So there was quite a bit of pressure I put on myself to find a new direction. But I knew that I had time, and I still enjoyed the tree work, to some sides of things. I mean, I was self-employed. I could delegate my time how I wanted. I could work with whoever I wanted. I was really happy with the group of boys I was spending time with. Every day was, every tree job's a puzzle. It's always exciting. You've got beautiful properties you're working in, nice views, those sorts of things. But yeah, I knew that I had a bit of time on my hands, but it was not going to be sustainable. So first of all, it was easy. The transition, I was flexible enough to have time to look for something else because I was self-employed. And as a self-employed climber, you can earn okay money. So I only really needed to work 2-3 days a week. So I had a couple more days where I could start to play with other things without feeling guilty. And so I did that for a long time. I guess a couple of issues with doing something like that is I didn't really have a clear plan, but I've just started following my interests, which is all well and good. But if you're looking for business, if you're doing this in the direction of business, then at some stage you'll come to the point of, should you invest in this machine or this tool or whatever or not? And with the mushrooms, I definitely sunk quite a bit of money into setting up this mushroom business that I just sort of flogged off quite spontaneously. And then lots of those sorts of issues constantly popping up. And I guess just seeing as the time carried on, seeing different business opportunities pop up, like when I realized that I could create that there is opportunity to expand on the spice range, I was like, well, should I be focusing on large scale spice harvesting or not? Or once I started making ice creams and realized that I could make a New Zealand native ice cream range, I was like, well, should I start making large scale ice cream or what am I doing? So that's been a side of things which I found I didn't really think about too much, but has probably been quite a big issue. I guess what I did that I found good was I just have just been following my interests. It's potentially selfish views, but or selfish motivation, but yeah, really just following what I've been interested in, and that can be hard to think about. What are you interested in as well? I mean, I was interested in spices, but was I really interested in large scale harvesting of native spices? You kind of have to try it out first, have a little play with it. So that's what I've been doing, and that's sort of how I stumbled into this project at the college. And yeah, that's probably the only. It's not really amazing advice, but it's.
I think it's awesome advice, Mike. I think it's really pertinent because I people that I speak to, whether they're friends or family or people that contact me through the podcast work, who struggle with this, often feel like they need to solve that question of what they're going to do before they leave the current thing. Right? They're like, well, what would I do if I didn't do this? What job would I have? And it's really hard to answer that question when you're in the grind of whatever current career you're pursuing, if you don't create some space to play and experiment and meet different people in different spheres and get exposed to different things, then how are you really going to know? So I take that as a really important sign that, yeah, you don't have to have the perfect answer and you won't know exactly what you're going to enjoy or like until you test things out and experiment. Really, really cool point about, you know, the questions that you get as soon as you start playing with something. It's like, right, do we take this to the next level? And I think there's a learning there too, right? Like you start experimenting with the ice cream and it's like, right, I could start like mass producing this and create an ice cream factory and invest and, you know, have to find the money to do that. But I really like what you've done where you've taken that ice cream learning and the spice and native plant learning kind of combined it in these foraging tours, which allow you to keep both things quite small scale, but still meet people. And so there's, I guess, you can be creative with what those solutions look like is what that says to me, that you can, it doesn't have to go down that mass production line necessarily. You can try and think a little bit more outside the box into how you can join those interests up and create value for people.
That's been a really interesting part of it too for me is along this journey has been that I discovered that I really like being creative and that's been has become really in the last year has become an important guiding arrow is that I'll enjoy being creative and I'm not that interested in business and marketing and sales. I really just enjoy experimenting and I guess the underlying interest of mine is nature. I'm going to put a put a stamp on that one. I'm really interested in the diversity of nature and all those sorts of things. There's so much, it's so quirky and weird, nature. And just try, I enjoy showing that to people, and I've always enjoyed from my friends when we've just been hanging out, just going into the garden and blabbering on about the weird facts I know about plants. And so finding new ways and cool tools to help show that to people has probably been, the biggest side of things for me. I mean, that's why I guess I got into the mushrooms without really realizing it. It's just because I found them fascinating and I wanted to show everyone these weird pink oyster mushrooms and stuff. So, but always the question comes in, but it's a business, so you've got to try and make money, and that always is,
How do I pay the bills? One question I want to ask was, how did you develop the knowledge of what is edible and what's not, in terms of what might be poisonous, what might be safe to eat? How did you build up that inherent database of knowledge in your own mind?
Well, I guess I already had a bit of a good starting point. So, I've been working in the green industry. That's what the Germans say, in the green industry for, the last 15 years. So I knew a lot about plants already, I suppose. And then it was just finding whether or not they're edible. I mean, I used the resources, the books that were available, which is a few. And then once I chewed through those books, we got to the point where a lot of what I was interested in learning about, you're not going to find in books anymore. So what I do now is I use a database called Plants for a Future, which is my go-to, really. And it's not an ID page, so it doesn't have any photos. But it's basically tells you about all the uses of plants. It's a British database, but it does have a lot of NZ native stuff in it, surprisingly. It's a really good database. And once you know the Latin name of the plant, then you just type that in, and it just tells you all of the uses for the plant. So if it has any medicinal uses, culinary uses, if it's good for dyeing, or if the timber's not any good for anything. And for me, what's really nice is it's got one section on the if there's any known hazards within the plant. And so that's sort of where I start. Yeah, have a look at that. And then if there's no known hazards in the plant, then I feel a bit more confident about playing around with it.
Cool.
I also needed one thing I guess I should mention. When I first started doing foraging for restaurants, I realized quite early on that I need a food safety certificate to do this. So commercial foraging. And that was an interesting rabbit hole to dive down. There's not many foragers around. And so I approached the council, and to start off with, they said, no, that's not possible. You can't bring wild mushrooms into a restaurant. And I started having an argument with the lady at the council that you wouldn't want to live in a world where you can't have wild mushrooms on the menu. And she was like, but you can grow them, you can cultivate them, and then, but not these ones, and blah, blah, blah. So in the end, the officer, the food safety officer that dealt with me ended up being another lady, and she was okay with it. Just had to find another forager in New Zealand that was already registered and find out what type of food safety certificate that person had, and then the council would feel much more comfortable about me doing it. And then I was privately audited by a private company, and they didn't know what questions to ask me. They'd never dealt with a forager before. And in the end, we decided I won't harvest blackberries or gorse flowers or leafy greens from public land because I can't guarantee it hasn't been sprayed with Roundup, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that was all good. That was basically the only rules, really, except for traceability. So I had to be able to say where I picked what and have that categorized or documented. So in the end, really, though, I never really harvested much. I'm not picking things for restaurants anymore, but when I was, I basically stopped harvesting on public land. It was always too awkward. There's not many places you can harvest. Like, I'm not allowed to harvest on the beachfront, and I'm not allowed to harvest, or the shoreline, I'm not allowed to harvest in parks and reserves. So you're basically public land. I'm only really allowed on the roadside.
Yeah.
And you can't really do that because of the hazards of being next to cars and pollution from cars and things like that. I mean, you could maybe on some gravel road down a quiet road, maybe you could do some harvesting. I'm not sure, but
really smart to be able to share that learning in your tours, though, right? Like, that's such a nice way to, I guess, segue into that, where you can still use that knowledge to add value, where you're kind of getting, it sounds like the establishment's making it very hard to use these public spaces, which have so much promise. So kudos to you for creating the tours. And I should just mention at this point that if people are interested, go to findersheedersforaging.com where you can book a tour with Mike. What do people get out of those tours? What do they come away from saying, and what are you trying to impart to people when they come along?
So I don't see myself as a walking encyclopedia of plant knowledge. I really, there's lots of plants I don't know, and there's lots of plants I'm not really interested in either. So I've never really bothered learning more. I guess what I do is I tell a story about my experience over the last 3 years, what I've been up to, which involves, experiences like dealing with the council when trying to become a registered professional forager, and my experiences with working with distilleries. And I didn't really like it. I was a bit disappointed. I got a bit disappointed in the whole marketing side of things. And I just kind of felt like that businesses, they didn't have the same passion that I did about promoting these plant products. It was all just about trying to sell something. And as soon as they had their product, then it was all about the kilo price and how much cheaper we can make it. And I couldn't justify my prices anymore. And I realized I'd have to start dealing with employees and going down that rabbit hole. So obviously we do talk a lot about plants and my experiences with using them. I never really considered myself a chef either. I don't do much. I mean, I do cook, but I don't use a lot of these ingredients. A lot of them are quite novelty products for high-end restaurants. And so I never really mucked around much with pickling and preserving either, which is a lot of what foraged products are. But I never really liked them. I never really liked the smell of vinegar in my house cooking away. It just never really been my jam. So for a long time, I never really wanted to do tours because I could ask all these questions, I know that this plant's edible and that plant's not edible, but I never really knew what I'd do with it. And it was only really through working with ice cream and finding a way that I enjoyed using these spices or these plant products that that I felt more connected to the whole thing and also found creativity in it as well, that I can now dive down more rabbit holes and just enrich my own knowledge. So there's that. So I guess what it is I'm telling a story and I'm talking a lot about different plants and my experiences with them. A lot of my stories are also Helen's stories from her restaurant and how she used them, and I tell those stories about having a bit of a glimpse into her world, because that's a fascinating side of things. It's just seeing how a chef works with plant products is really fascinating. One day, this is a great little story. So I went in there and she got me to try this weird powder. And turns out it was, she had juiced carrots and then she'd taken the pulp from the carrot, fermented it, dehydrated it, ground it into a powder. And then that was the powder. So it's fermented carrot pulp. And it was zingy and weird. And so, in the future, I could imagine, diving down the rabbit hole of fermenting stuff. It seems to really make amazing flavors, but I haven't yet. But and then there's the ice creams, and that's always great fun. I found with the ice creams, I've been on a few foraging tours in the past, and I was always a little bit, I'd walk away a bit disappointed. We'd make like a salad or we'd nibble on some seaweed or something, and it was okay, but never really walked away thinking, I'm totally going to go and try this now. It was always sort of like, that was interesting, but whatever. Like, for a good example is Harakeke seeds. If you nibble on Harakeke, so New Zealand flax seeds, those little black surfboard seeds, if you nibble on those, they're kind of mild, you don't really taste much. They say they're high in omegas, but I never really cared. And I've never really been interested in the medicinal side of things either. But with ice cream, if you take half a cup of those seeds, toast them in a pan, grind them up, soak them in the base mix of the ice cream for 24 hours, you really get this nutty, musky flavor. It's like a unique musky flavor out of the ice cream. And you can smell that flavor. You can smell it when you walk past the bush when the seed pods are ripening. They'll crack open and you get this waft of this musky smell that just when you walk past it, it just stops you in your tracks and brings you straight back to the ice cream. And so people walk away from the ice cream tasting and I think they walk away excited and inspired to play with them themselves. And that's probably been, that's been a real highlight for me.
It's so nice. And just fostering that connection between all of us and the plants that we walk past every day, but don't stop to appreciate. I think that's of so much value, man. I appreciate you doing that work. It's something that can add so much value. Like I've got so much learning to do in this space. And when we went to the Earthworkers course, such a noob, they had just had like leaves of kawakawa, and they had they were just making tea. They were just making tea there. And my daughter, Charlotte's got like at home this little like kawakawa balm that's made on Waiheke Island. It's like really good. You put it on like if you've got any like skin things going on. And so after going to the course, I like took Charlotte out to this big valley set in Osada Park near where we live, and we were looking for kawakawa, and we found some because it's everywhere. And we, you know, it was really nice to connect for her that right, these are the leaves that go into this balm that she loves playing with. And came home, made a bit of a tea, and then I'm looking out my kitchen window and there's literally like a kawakawa bush right outside my kitchen window. I just never even knew what it was, you know. And I'm running around trying to find this native plant, and the whole time it's literally like a meter from where I spend half of my day.
yeah that's awesome.
Just because I didn't know, because I didn't have this knowledge or understanding of what that plant even was, which is...
Well, you'll find this interesting. So specifically kawakawa, for me, has been a really exciting one. And not because of the leaves at all. I don't use the leaves at all because everyone already knows them and they use them, and that's great. But what a lot of people aren't aware of, so you know you can eat kawakawa berries, little orange sticks. They're mildly sweet. If you eat the flesh of the berry, they're full of seeds, little black seeds. If you weren't to bite down on those seeds, that would be a mildly sweet berry. But as soon as you bite down on those sticker seeds, it's like you get that peppery kick that you would from kawakawa. And that's great. And restaurants had asked me in the past to try and harvest kawakawa berries, and always seemed like an impractical berry to harvest because you have two hundred berries on the bush. The bush is laden with berries, but they'll only ripen up one at a time. So it always seemed like an impractical berry to harvest. I'd go out for an hour and I'd come back and have maybe 10 berries and they're half eaten by birds. And I just never really liked doing it. And then one day, one of the gin distilleries I worked for asked me if they wanted a kilo price on kawakawa berries. And I was like, oh, I'm not interested. And he said, well, we're going to dehydrate them anyway, so it doesn't matter if they're green. And as soon as I realized that, it became a far more practical berry to harvest. So I can harvest kilos off a bush in one go. It's far more practical. And the quality of the spice is really good. It's an amazing spice. It's like it's much more rich and layered than the leaf is. It's got like I always call it the New Zealand Christmas spice. It's got like a ginger nut touch to it, mint. It's really nice spice. And so that's something I really like talking about, is the fact that everyone knows kawakawa, everyone uses the leaf. Most people know about eating the berries, but it's just that you can pick the berries green and turn that into a spice that not many people are aware of. So it's just one of the things I really like to promote and chat about. And then there's the male flowers too, because kawakawa is dioecious, meaning that male and female are on separate plants. And the male flowers have potential to be used as a spice. So it's an example of one of the things which I think that we can expand on, the native spices.
How would you turn those berries into a spice? Would that be like a mortar and pestle thing? Would you sort of like grind them up and...
You could use fresh green kawakawa berries. It's pretty intense. But I just chuck them in the dehydrator and then they turn into these black, skinny little sticks full of the flesh of the berry sort of just disintegrates into nothing and you just get this stick of black seeds. Yeah, and then I personally just grind them up in a coffee grinder. So my tools are really just a dehydrator, a coffee grinder, and an ice cream machine. And I've recently ordered a still, so I'd like to start mucking around more with capturing hydrosols and essential oils and blending those into ice blocks and ice creams and just showcasing, because a lot of the flavors don't work with cream, and I'm just trying to find new other ways to help carry flavors. And I can imagine, essential oils and hydrosols being a useful tool. I've also really, really loved, I would love to buy a freeze dryer, but it's like $8,000-$9,000 for
a year.
Yeah. So, but that would be awesome. I'd love to get a freeze dryer as well. And just having new tools and new ways to help showcase flavors to people.
Fantastic, Mike. I hope there is a freeze dryer in your future at some point.
Me too, man. Not many on Trade Me, but one day.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about the foraging, which I really encourage people to go on one of those tours. If someone is not in the Kapiti Coast or in Wellington to do the Botanical Gardens tour, you mentioned that Plants for a Future website. Are there any other resources or places you would send people if they're interested in learning more about foraging and just appreciating the plants that are around us already or on their own land?
I mean, the books that I would just generally go to, this foraging books by Andrew Crow. It's like a field guide at a native.
I've got one of his ones. Yeah, it does really well on native ones.
Yeah, that's a great starting point, that one. There's also another book, it's like The Forager's Treasury by a lady called Joanna Knox. That's a nice one. If in regards to seaweed and mushrooms, I always recommend a couple of PDFs by a guy called Peter Langlands in the South Island. He's probably the most well-known forager. He wrote up a couple of foraging books and, PDFs, which you can order from him. His company's called Wild Capture. And I specifically found the seaweed and the mushrooms useful. I mean, they're not the best photos and they're not the greatest ID pages themselves, but what he does is he just focuses in on the top 15 varieties that you're going to find, and that's just a really nice way to hone in on it, especially mushrooms. I mean, seaweed's the same. There's hundreds of varieties of seaweed around the Wellington coastline, and you can just get lost in all of it. So just having a way to narrow it down, and then he talks about the, you know, lookalikes as well. So found those to be really useful tools.
Personally, like I've read that, I've got one of the Andrew Crow books on native plants, and there's some real quality photos in there and a lot of drawings and things, but I still have this trepidation. Like, I don't know if it's just bias from my upbringing or the way, you know, what I've been surrounded by growing up, but I have this kind of fear of like jumping into like picking something and trying it that I'm going to eat something wrong and it's going to be poisonous. Do you think is there an overestimation? Say this with any disclaimer, but is that fear inherent in you know, too much? Has that been bred into us, or you know, should we be really careful, or are there kind of things to watch out for or advice you'd give for people to kind of get past that fear that certainly I've had about engaging more with edible native plants?
Good question. I would say that there are definitely plants out there that can kill you or seriously injure you, or what's the word, make you very sick. But that's no reason to stop playing with the plants. I mean, do your research and have a play. Let me put it this way. There's lots of plants that you find saying that they're poisonous. You'll see in one book it'll say they're poisonous, and then in the next book they're being used for medicinal purposes. So it also has there's also a question of quantity. But there are some plants that you should stay away from, for example, hemlock, and that looks very similar to wild carrot seed. And if you start with wild carrot, so if you start mucking around with leafy greens, you should definitely know about hemlock. And it's not that hard to learn about it. It's basically highlighted in every book, hey, watch out for hemlock. So yes, there are poisonous plants out there and you should be cautious, but it's not rocket science. It's all doable, I think. But I have poisoned myself. I've got a nice little story about...
Sure, if you're open to it.
The one time I poisoned myself, I was working for the gin distilleries and I read somewhere in the database for, I think it was Māori medicinal plant use database, that kauikaui used to be used as a quinine alternative or a tonic alternative for malaria. It's really bitter, in the bark and the leaves. So I told this to one of the gin distilleries. I was like, oh, that'd be awesome. How cool would it be to make a New Zealand tonic water? So I grabbed some bark and some leaves and I boiled them up into a broth. And then I bought a bottle of gin and I bought a bottle of tonic water and a bottle of soda water. And at the time, it was a long time ago, I didn't really know what my goal was or what my plan was. I wasn't even trying to figure out what I wanted to taste. And what I really should have done is just had some soda water and put some in and decided whether or not it tastes like tonic water or not. And that would have been the end of it. But after my experiments, I maybe had two shot glasses of this brew when I really only should have had a teaspoon of it. And about 20 minutes later, my guts just flipped out. And I felt crook for about 3 days. I think I did my gut biome some real damage. And to be honest, ever since then, I still struggle now with fatty foods. So fish and chips is what I really have to pay attention to how much I'm eating. But maybe that's just getting old. I don't know. So that's the only time I've really poisoned myself. Yeah, you could definitely hurt yourself. But at the same time, I see kauikaui in some rōanga concoctions. And so,
yeah.
I mean.
So it's, like you're saying, it's the dose, right? Like if you boil it up and all that's getting into the water and then you have the two shot glasses of it, that could be quite an intense dose of whatever's in that plant, rather than if it's a medicinal use, it might be used pretty sparingly just different parts of it. So, yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good learning.
It's probably the same with lots of different essential oils. You can totally overdo your gut biome.
Yeah. No, thanks for sharing that, Mike. That's a really important story and really useful, I think. So thanks, man. And we would love to talk to you about more about the Otaki project.
Yeah.
And so where we left that previously in the conversation, we're talking about, you know, the speed dating, securing funding, and, you know, you come out of this boodhooey with the council, you found some funding. And so tell us about the space and what the transition has looked like.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Otaki College has an amazing horticultural facility. It is really impressive by any standard. It's silly. It's weird that they had this facility. It was locked behind closed gates. They hadn't taught horticulture there in 5 years. Hadn't really been looking any good for about the last 10 years. The problem with it is it's too large. It's too much for the horticulture teacher to run himself, to expect him to run it in his private time. So we realized there was the opportunity to justify a funded role. So we acquired funding for a 20-hour-a-week role. So I started working there Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays during school hours with students on a one-on-one mentoring basis. So they'd come out and work with me. So I have a timetable like all the other students, and every hour a different student comes out and works with me.
Wow.
Which I started the first 3 months, I just worked by myself because the work was too dangerous to having students involved. Because the students I'm dealing with too, it's an intermediate. So most of the kids that I deal with are between 10 and 13. Seems to be the older kids are a bit busy with their exams and NZQA tickets or whatever. That I generally get the younger kids coming out to work with me. So yeah, started working on renovating it. It has a massive big greenhouse with heat-sensitive automated sides. It's got a big packing shed. It's got a second greenhouse with heated beds for raising seedlings. We have outdoor veggie. We've got established orchards. We've got multi-medicinal corner. We've got a pizza oven corner. We've got bees. It's really impressive.
It's also, I should just cut it. Sorry to cut in there, Mark. I was just going to say, you shared photos and videos from when you first started, and I feel like you might be overselling it. It needed a lot of work when you first got there. Like, there was piles of, you know, who knows what, and there were weird chemicals that you had to find a way of disposing of. And there was, I don't want to undersell how much of a transition this involved and how much work this would have been for you at the start.
It was quite intimidating being standing there by myself with no one to bounce ideas off, no one to make decisions with. It definitely was. I guess the tip there is just to make a base, which was the greenhouse for me. The greenhouse was the first step because it was winter when I was working there too, so I was always cold and the packing shed's not very nice. So, yeah, turn the greenhouse into a nice space, and then that's your go-to space at the beginning, and then slowly spread out from there. But there was always a juggle for me between working on infrastructure and renovating things and growing veggies at the same time so that people are already seeing something coming out of there. But you don't want to spend too much time on the veggies because you're just taking time away from building and renovating and painting and whatever. It was a real mess. It was a real mess, I have to say. I guess the issue has been there's been quite a few community groups had tried getting in there over the years, and that was potentially counterproductive because they'd get in there, they'd have a go, they'd get some funding from somewhere, buy some stuff, throw it in, and then it would fall apart. And then 2 years later, another group would have another go and they'd get in. And so you'd have all these weird sort of projects stacking up on top of each other, and just clearing it all away and making a clean slate was a lot of work. But I really enjoyed it. I loved the project. You could see the potential. I've enjoyed working with the students. That's been a lot of fun. I've noticed, just building over the last 8 months, building relationships with the students. I mean, now they're really getting into it now that the place is looking nice, and they come out before school or they come out at lunchtime and they're looking for jobs. These are students that I don't even have on my schedule. It just seemed like a really nice place. So you can, you know, at lunchtime when they're out there, you hear them squawking and running around, and that's been really nice to give that to them.
What were some of the first? So you set up the greenhouse as a bit of a base. What were some of the first things you grew, or what were some of the first crops that you went with?
Well, what I should have done is done a soil test to begin with, which I didn't do straight away. I did that in connection to the earthworkers course. I never even thought about doing a soil test, but somewhere along the lines on the earthworker course, they mentioned that you should do one and that they will analyze the test for us. So I did that a bit further down the track than I thought than I should have. And so and I realized, well, we discovered lead poisoning in some of the beds. We did manage to narrow it down. I'm really happy that we could sort of solve the problem. But at the time, we didn't know, so I couldn't grow any. I decided I won't grow, well, before we then can actually narrow down where exactly this lead's coming from, we won't grow any root crops. So it was all pretty basic to begin with, just lettuces and fennel. Basically, I didn't know what I was doing, and I was just grabbed whatever seedlings I could get my hands on, and whatever grew well kind of went in the ground. And I guess what I'll mention is I went on another course. I went on Roebuck Farms. I went on Jody Roebuck's salad mix course for a couple of days, and that was a really useful course as well, where I learned a lot about salad mix production, and I found that really interesting. So now a lot of our focus, not a lot of our focus, but say half of our focus is on salad mix production. And that's, I found that to be really a nice way to engage with the students, because each job that you do is only a small job, like growing microgreens or growing pea shoots, that every job just takes 5 minutes, and it's and you see the results within a couple of weeks, which is useful too for the students to see that sort of feedback. And then you're creating an added value product, putting it together, which is another little job, mixing the salad together. And then we sell veggie boxes to the teachers. So we do about 10 veggie boxes a week. But at the beginning,
awesome.
Man, I was just throwing stuff together, whatever grew well. I mean, brassicas seemed to germinate well. So all through summer, I had a ridiculous amount of brassicas that were just getting hammered by the white butterfly. Yeah, it is what it is.
How do you keep it fun for kids? Like, do they just naturally, enjoy it? Or are there steps that you take to keep it fun for them? Because sometimes with farming spaces, if you've got a plant, 144 seeds in a cell tray, and then you've got to do a whole lot of trays, like, you can feel like you can get a bit tedious for some people. But the steps that you take, and you mentioned the microgreens one, which seems really valuable, because you get that instant feedback and you can start to see them sprouting pretty quick. Are there other things that you do to increase that engagement factor? And I guess I'm asking for, like, maybe people have got kids at home and they want to see if they expose their kids to gardening and see if they can see if they like it and they become interested in it.
Well, I mean, the quick turnover is good. That's always a great starting point. But I found, so basically what happens is I have these kids come out to me for the first time. I have maybe half an hour with them. And in that time, in the first session, they're going to decide whether or not they want to come back. So I feel like I've got this half an hour time to sort of blow them away with nature. So I give them the tour. And I've noticed along the lines that, immediate sensory stuff is the best. So smells and tastes. So I've got a lot of herbs in our garden. So I give them the whole tour of the herbs. And that's always an easy way to spark their interest. And one thing I've also done in maybe the last 3 months is I've set up my ice cream production in the packing shed, which has been nice. So what I do is I make one ice cream a week with the students. And the rule is we have to use one ingredient from the garden in the ice cream. So, I mean, we've made chili and chocolate, because we've got lots of chilies growing in the greenhouse, made basil ice cream. We've made walnut and honey with our own walnuts and our own honey. Made mint and chocolate chip, grapefruit, feijoa. Next week, actually, when we go back, I'll be making rhubarb and rose geranium sorbet. So that's a really easy way. I mean, I go around with the students, I talk to them about all the herbs. We try a couple of different ice creams, and I can show them the spices or the herbs that were used in the ice cream. So yeah, that seems to be a good approach to it, I found. But yeah, you're right. There are a lot of tedious jobs, and you have to. But I've only got each student for 45 minutes, so it never really gets tedious. By the time they get out to me and I've told them the job to do, it's about half an hour for them. So you can't really go too wrong with half an hour. But you have to watch out that I don't bore them or give them something too tough. And now that I've been getting used to the project, they come out in pairs as well. So that can be quite a useful way for them to spend time. Or to not get bored or not find it too tedious is when they're working with a mate.
my four-year-old boy, Connor, he loves to help out in the garden. And yeah, there are times when he's just thriving in it. You know, when we open up a compost bin and we'll get some of the compost out and we just look at all the worms and all the little bugs frittering around, and you know, he'll love that experience. And then, you know, I'll kind of bore him to tears once I say, right, we're going to shovel, you know, wheelbarrow loads of this compost around the property, and he'll stick with me for a little while, but probably get bored after a bit. But I love the food as a vehicle for engagement, and that's something I'll definitely try to build into my own experience with the kids in the garden, is right, saying, what can we make out of this, or what can we turn this into, or how can we turn this into an ice cream? Sounds like such a fun way to experiment. Do you have a good like ice cream recipe that you would be open to sharing or could link to?
So I get my base mixes from, it's a company called Salt and Straw. Okay. They put out a book not too long ago, which has all of their base mixes in it, and that's a really good resource for me.
Perfect.
And also, I got their coconut base mixes and their sorbet base mixes. And so, yeah, it's basically just milk, cream, milk powder, sugar, glucose, syrup, and xanthan gum. So there's no egg white as a stabilizer. That's what I use.
And you find the fat and the sugar can be a nice carrier for these flavors to come through. And I guess it would kind of like soften them and things as well on some of the herbs.
So
that
some things, if you know, on bitter and nutty flavors it works really well. Sour and spicy, not so well. Cream can smother them. But then you've got other options. So then you could use a sorbet, or for example, if it's a sour flavor that you want to get, let's say you want to make a boysenberry ice cream. If you just mix boysenberries into cream, you're not going to get that sour twang that you're looking for. So what they do, and you'll know this, is they make like a compote or a swirl, and then they mix that into the ice cream in the last minute so that you've still got that jamminess in the ice cream. And then when you lick it, you'll get that sourness from the jam as well as the creaminess. So you've got different ways to try and lure the flavor out. So that's another thing that I find fascinating about it all, and it helps with the keeping it creative and interesting for me, is trying to find different ways to showcase a flavor. It doesn't have to be cream, but you've got lots of options.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about was you actually have found some really fun ways to engage with the students too. And you mentioned one that you've just started playing with, but which was like the kind of Saturday night tasting events, which you may run more of in the future, where you actually had kids playing musical instruments and kind of hosting this kind of event where the public could come along and try different flavors.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been trying to find ways to connect the community more to the college gardens, because it is tucked away a little bit. It is behind, you know, we do lock the gates at night. So I have been calling it a community garden, but at the same time, we don't open it up all the time to the community. So it's been a weird one trying to figure out how is this going to work in the future, and how can we connect more to the community. And I was thinking, so I open up the gates on Saturday mornings to the general public, for volunteers, I suppose. But really, it's also just to show people around. And I spend, you know, I'll give everyone 20 minutes to show them, give them the tour and tell them my plans and whatever. And then, I realized I turned the greenhouse into a bit of a classroom. So half the space is growing space and half of it's a classroom. And that, I realized, works really well. The students like it. It's a nice space, especially now that we're getting into the colder times. And I realized I'm sure I could hold an event there. I was just trying to think of a way to do it. And I thought, okay, it has to be at nighttime, because during the daytime, the temperatures are too unpredictable in the greenhouse. And at nighttime, I've got a gas heater so I can make it cozy in there. So I started to realize, okay, let's try ice cream tasting. And not everyone's interested in going on a 2-3 hour foraging walk and hearing about plants. It just can be quite educational, but not necessarily everyone's cup of tea. But everyone likes trying ice creams, and everyone, I'm sure everyone's curious about native flavors. So started hosting these events and realized that it's a great way to connect the community to the college, because I can work with the students. Yeah, so I have the student band playing music. In the future, I haven't done this yet, but I can have students being the waiters, being the MC, I suppose, in the future. I don't know. So that's been really good. They work really well. It's a great event, a lot of fun. And I just, added another one yesterday, actually. So that'll be good.
Such a cool way to let your students kind of show off what they've been working on too, if they want to invite family along, I imagine.
Yeah. I also like the idea. I mean, the space is really good for having younger kids come in. So one thing that I've noticed with the garden really in the last couple of months is that it's a great space to facilitate kindies, play centres, young school groups, to bring them in, spend a few hours there. They go picking fruit, they pick veggies. We can even crank up the pizza oven. We give them ice cream, and they love it. The little kids, they get to climb up the ladder and they get to try figs and apples. And we got a really wide variety of fruits there. So that's been really nice. And I've been just humming and hawing about ways that we can do more towards dealing with these younger kids. I really like the idea. I think the facility is fantastic for school holiday programs. And now I was thinking in the greenhouse, it'd be great to, I've been chatting to Kate, the learning support coordinator. She's basically my contact at the college, but she happens to be a drama teacher as well. And I thought it'd be cool to put on like a show in the greenhouse. Mm-hmm. Then we can move the tables and chairs around in there and just put beanbags and pillows and things in there. And then, yeah, have some sort of show and we could work with the students and the drama department or the music department or to create some sort of shows for the kids.
I think it's something that makes me so passionate about this kind of urban farm movement, which the Earthworkers program and the For the Little Bees Trust are trying to support, is bringing these vibrant green spaces into urban environments so it's not tucked away in rural areas, although that's obviously necessary too, but that we can have some of these spaces in amongst our urban centres and cities where your play centres and kindergarten groups can come and visit them and school students can engage and see a whole diverse mix of plants growing and see the potential and try the flavours and just be exposed to all the stuff. So kudos to you, Mike, and thank you so much for your hard work in that space. One question I was going to ask on this was, if someone's listening to this and they're in a different part of the country and they drive past a spot maybe every day and they think, gosh, that is an underutilized area where something like what you've done could happen, what would you recommend they do? How would they best kind of investigate that or look into that?
Yeah. I would say the Earthworkers course was great. That was a really good starting point for me. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad that was the first step I took. And a lot of the worries which I had when I first started was the weeds. I was so intimidated by the weeds. I thought I had to put weed mat on this stuff to get started and kill it all and then have a good starting point. And that really wasn't an issue at all. I was so surprised how when you put down some compost on top, I was thinking, all right, I'm going to have to buy cardboard and I'm going to have to lay it out. It's going to make it look really nice. But it didn't need to be like that at all. It really was just do a soil test and that you really get that one out of the way first, go on a course to wrap your head around it all, and then at the same time start making compost. Good starting point as well. And then good healthy seedlings going in and quantity, really thick planting is a good starting point. But I'm sure there's other elements that you need to cover too. I mean, this was a funded project, so the question of getting an income was not so important, but I'm sure that is important for a lot of other people. So I don't know about that side of things. I don't think I could still make an income off what I'm doing over there at the moment. So I probably shouldn't say too much about that side of things.
But there is certainly more of a movement towards funding for situations like this, as much as it can be still very hard. There seems to be more money flowing into the space and more people seeing the value of these kinds of projects, right?
Absolutely. You're right. That's another really interesting point, is that there is funding opportunities. I think if you can show how it's good for the community, that's a really important factor.
No, yeah, I appreciate your time so much, Mike. I like the diverse range of topics that we covered, and I really appreciate you.
It's a funny story, eh? No worries. It has been an interesting ride, and I'm still really excited to see how things go for me.
Yeah, I love that theme of creating space to play, creating space to be creative, and explore your interests. I think something that we can all benefit more from, right? We give a lot of time to our careers and to our jobs, and it's really a value to have space to pursue things that make you happy.
Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers, Mike. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for this. Take care. And wish you the best of luck with the future, with the foraging tours, with the ice cream making, with getting your freeze dryer, and with Old Bucky College, your project there too.
Cheers, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends and check out our previous episodes for lots of other cool info like this. And head along to our website, goodyoucando.com, to subscribe to future updates. You can also follow us on Instagram @goodyoucando.